as well as my 15 years in public service, 5 years on the Champaign County Board, 2 years as an alderman in the city of Urbana, and 7 years as a state legislator. I brought to the role the same tenacious fire I had when I co-founded Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice as a member of the NAACP, working to pass prison reform legislation, temporary workers' rights, protection of the Muhammad Aquifer, repeal the criminalization of people living with HIV, and access to affordable higher education. I had the same passion when I helped move the four pillars to end systemic racism with the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus, and when I advocated with all of my might to ensure the historic vote of the first African-American Speaker of the House of Representatives in Illinois' over 200-year history. During the course of my journey as a Black woman and leader, I have always been unapologetic in my fight for truth, justice, and equity. My work is steeped in authenticity and integrity. To be clear, my journey has borne witness to the reality that inequities and the need to demand respect exist on all levels. And while I know I have not compromised my dignity or violated anyone else's, on May 29, 2021, I was asked to take my folding chair to another table. As an activist organizer, it has always been important to highlight the contradictions within a society, organizations, or relationships. In the 7 years I've been in Springfield, I have witnessed the exact same argument be received differently based on the gender and or hue of the skin of the person delivering it. That reality was never a deterrent for me prior to being given a seat at the table of leadership, and it will not be a deterrent for me going forward. I was taught that leadership is honest work and correct thinking, and therefore it can come from anyone at any time. As your representative, I want you all to know that I remain committed to working honestly and being well prepared to offer the correct analysis of any bill I work on or any relationship that develops while working on your behalf. In short, I will continue to offer leadership whether my folding chair has a space at the table or if I have to pick it up and move it to another location. In service, Carol Ammons.
Go ahead, Sister Carol. And as John Lee Johnson used to say,
it's the right kind of trouble.
As Paul Mew says, John Lewis said, and I agree, and obviously Representative Ammons does too. Let's get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
So Paul, this is just a protocol. There's no written rule that you have to vote for every bill that comes through.
Anyway. Well, Paul, you know.
Well, you said other leaders that were not voting on certain things, so.
That's I guess they want you to abstain or something.
They should probably say that, but anyway.
I'm going to get you to call back on the studio, not the studio line, 359-9338, please. Yeah, thanks. I think I'm on mic. Am I loud enough? We've got new mic amplifiers in here, so if they're more careful about being there. Okay, that was informative. That was amazing. I want to know more about some of this money that's going to the IMC, actually. I haven't seen anything about that yet. We need an article about that.
We will have an article soon, Paul. We just got to make sure that... Yeah,
dot all the I's and cross all the T's and all that.
The man got to sign the budget.
Yeah. Yeah, don't want to... 359-9338 for somebody who wants to talk to the Ammons, unless they're dashing off. You're not on your bikes this week, I see.
No. Today.
I'm going to have to accelerate some of this stuff. I've got some election theft report from my man. You know, I got so distracted, I didn't even set up. That's crazy. I couldn't even get out of the car because I wanted to listen, keep listening to you guys. So it's going to be a little bit of an editing of the list. I'm going to start with... A underwriting announcement that I usually play at the end. Radio Free Labor with Gus Woods. Very informative segment on Tulsa. Stuff that I had not heard anywhere else that went out last. You guys are here two weeks in a row. That's great.
Yeah,
I turned on the radio.
Now we're here this week.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see. I'm hearing the old dial tone. They ought to get a new tone. We're in a new age, right? Let's hear from Minuteman Press, and then maybe that'll give me a time to do what I should have done when I first came in the door, but I said I was pretty transfixed by that. I mentioned the election theft report. It's not entirely fresh. KPFA has been having a pledge drive. I've got something from the Tax Justice Network, and I'm going to edit that on the fly because that's going to be at the very end. A little assessment of the fiscal policy and some of how it looks from over in the UK. TaxJustice.net if you want to look for that. Going to play the entirety of it tomorrow. So it's a really odd program, but I really like it because, well, nobody's doing it here in the U.S., anything like a show that talks on how the New York legislature tried to get a transaction tax not even passed, just reinstated. They have one already. Taxing Wall Street is passed in 1905 under the Bull Moose Party. And they suspended it in the mid-70s under Lindsay, a Democratic. Was he governor, I guess? Well, it was a governor that did it. Lindsay was New York. I can't recall. But it's it's not a commonplace story, but there actually was a transaction tax, Tobin tax, which we need desperately, and it's not being talked about at all. Here's a little underwriting announcement.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. For a few special invitations printed or thousands of full-color flyers, Minuteman Press can help get it done on time and in budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Due to COVID-19, please contact Minuteman Press for safe ordering, pickup, and delivery options. Phone 217-355-0550. They are located at 905 South Neal Street in Champaign or champagneprinting.com.
Thank you, Vicki. Thank you, Minuteman. I guess they do our printing for us. Oops, that's the wrong device. So, one thing I'm focusing on is an event that's going on over the next couple of days, and it's a protest against a pipeline. Pipelines are connected. This one is connected. There is a action up in Minnesota I want to tell you about. And actually, I've got a producer, Sonali Kalatkar from California, who's actually talking about it. It's called the Treaty People's Gathering. They're doing a direct action to stop Line 3. It's Enbridge. One of the things they're going to do is put the pipeline under the Mississippi in the headwaters. Sounds like a great idea. They ran it so well in the Dakotas, right? All right, Amy Goodman. I'm going to try and kick it off with her. And no Mumi Abu-Jamal. I've been meaning to talk about the last two episodes of Philly DA and see if they cover the details about Abu-Jamal. But I haven't been real-timing it. I have to catch up on that. When we ever get a rainy day, I plan on watching the last two episodes of Philly DA. Not surprised when I found out that it was actually a videographer-producer that came out of Democracy Now!'s projects, if you will. And, yeah, if I didn't do a disclaimer, I'll do one right now. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers. Election theft report come up after Amy Goodman's segment. And, yeah, hope you're having a relaxing day. It's been pretty exciting for me so far since I didn't do what I should have done when I first came in. Here's Amy Goodman's segment. Breaking the sound barrier.
The lethal nexus, mass shootings and domestic violence. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. You know, the United States is emerging from the COVID-19 pandemic when the pace of mass shootings gets back to normal. As of June 2nd, there were 244 mass shootings in the U.S. this year. That's 1 to 2 per day. The place and time of the next of these horrific acts is unknown, but that one will happen is a certainty. Then another, and another. One consequence of the number of mass shootings in the U.S. is that we possess data related to the crimes, which show a correlation between mass shooters and domestic violence. A majority of the men who commit mass shootings, and men commit at least 97% of them, also have a history of domestic violence. That knowledge, along with sensible, fully enforced gun control measures, could help stem the epidemic of mass shootings that blights our society and save the lives of women threatened by intimate partner violence. Early in the morning of May 26th, as workers at the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority light rail hub prepared trains for the morning commute, employee Samuel Cassidy, 57 years old, arrived and within an hour embarked on a shooting rampage, killing 9 of his co-workers before taking his own life. He had 3 pistols with him, as many as 32 magazines, at least some of which were illegal in California, and dozens more guns at home. The guns he used were all registered and purchased legally. Cecilia Nelms, Cassidy's ex-wife, told the New York Times, he said of his co-workers several times, "I wish I could kill them." Nelms and Cassidy divorced in 2004 after 10 years of marriage, during which time Cassidy became increasingly given to fits of rage and uncontrollable anger with her. In 2009, Samuel Cassidy sought a restraining order against an ex-girlfriend. In her court filing, rebutting his accusations, the ex-girlfriend detailed occasions when Cassidy raped her and other times when he attempted to do so. She described episodes of his alcohol-fueled mood swings and violent rages.
The nexus between firearms violence and domestic violence is a particularly lethal one.
That's Julia Weber of the Giffords Law Center, an expert on domestic violence policy. She was speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
We have over 1 million women alive today in the United States who have been shot or shot at by male partners. We have 600 women a year, at least, who are killed by their intimate partners as a result of firearms violence. That's one about every 14 hours or so.
Giffords is the gun violence prevention organization co-founded by former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who was shot in the head in Tucson while meeting constituents in a shopping center parking lot January 8, 2011. She survived with brain injuries that she continuously works to overcome. 6 people were killed by the mass shooter that day. 12 were injured. Julia Weber describes some of the actions that would help stop perpetrators of domestic violence from committing acts of mass violence.
Getting the firearms from someone who currently owns firearms and becomes prohibited. It means ensuring that we have universal background checks so that if someone who is prohibited attempts to purchase firearms or ammunition, that would show up and they would in fact be denied. We also need to do a much better job addressing misogyny and domestic violence from the start. That is, recognizing that there's real harm that occurs as a result of gender bias.
A recent study from researchers at the University of Indianapolis found that, quote, male abusers with guns who take the lives of their intimate partners are much more likely to take the lives of others at the same time. The study also summarized earlier findings that, quote, the presence of a firearm in the home has been shown to increase the risk of death in domestic violence situations as much as 5-fold, unquote. In 2020, Bloomberg News published a study of 749 mass shootings, finding that 60% of those mass shootings were perpetrated during an act of domestic violence or by a man with a history of domestic violence. Bloomberg also found that mass shootings perpetrated by domestic abusers had a consistently higher body count. The COVID-19 pandemic trapped countless women at home with their abusers, sparking increased calls to domestic violence hotlines. There was also a surge in gun purchases. Small Arms Analytics reported that in a country already awash with over 300 million guns, more than 26 million guns were sold in the U.S. in 2020 alone. 2 necessary steps to stop mass shootings are to deny men who beat and abuse women at home the freedom they currently enjoy to buy and own guns, and to take violence against women seriously, strengthening the laws and institutions that protect them from their abusers. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, some of it came to me. That's sobering stuff. That you can, there's call-ins, but there's also text-in, which has the convenience of not revealing, being overheard if you're a perpetrator in your own private space is listening. Okay, probably won't get to much of election, material from TaxCast, but like I say, I'll be packaging a program of that tomorrow. I might be listening when I'm driving back from St. Louis. It's my mother's birthday tomorrow, so got to make the trip. I want to make the trip. So enough about me. And yeah, I mentioned both the election theft report and the pipeline protest that's going on in Minnesota. We'll get to Nancy Beaulieu. Means beautiful place in French, and I'm sure there's a beautiful place in northern Minnesota that are working on. It's the Enbridge pipeline. It does come through, you know, and connect to the activities here in western Illinois as well. But I'm going to kick it with the election theft report because, well, he's back. I haven't heard any outtakes from the speech today in North Carolina. Trump's on board. This is the election protection report. Mostly about Georgia again, because they're doing so much. I'm sure he'll have an update about Texas. Greg Palast on his website does have an article about the Texas go-round. It's hard to judge which one is the worst, I guess, in the way of restrictive bills, new Jim Crow bills. All right. Yeah, this has the historic intro to election theft report. Played these during the lead up to 2016 and the last election cycle too, and they're still doing them because there's so much activity in suppressing the next elections.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat. But we have it so well under control. It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
Now the Democrats are politicizing the coronavirus. And this is their new hoax.
Well, I think treatment in many ways might be more exciting.
You know, we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that get better. Just by, you know, sitting around and even going to work. Some of them go to work, but they get better.
You are an idiot.
All right. Well, you know,
don't do that, right? And so it's very easy to disqualify ballots. So they didn't fill in a bubble right. They put a check instead of filling in a bubble to be read by a machine. They used a red pen instead of a blue or black pen, or they used a pencil. These are the, you know, mistakes. You left out a middle initial that you registered with, and or you added a middle initial that you didn't register with. Again, the so-called exact match requirement will result in out of these 200,000 ballots, I would not be surprised, Dennis. Get ready for this, my friends, that they will find 12,000 ballots with picayune little errors, including such things as you lost the envelope, so you used your own envelope to mail it in. You folded it wrong. All kinds of things like that. This is, and what they're going to claim is, oh, Trump really won the state. These are fraudulent ballots. There's a difference between a ballot spoiled and not countable under Georgia's crazy rules because you folded it wrong, literally, or used the wrong color pen, and this happens a lot. They will say, oh, there was in fact massive fraud by black voters because we're counting in the black county. And therefore, Trump really won. This is proof the election was stolen from him. If it happened in Georgia, it happened everywhere else. So this, I'm very concerned about this so-called recount, and especially because the liberal media has all but crowned this guy, Raffensperger, leading this count as a great and honest man. So then when he announces, look, we found 12,000 disqualified ballots, they're going to say, there you go. I guess he must be right. I guess Trump won Georgia, and by extension, it probably happened nationwide. So look out. This is really dangerous stuff. But I hate to tell you, it's not the most dangerous stuff that I found in Georgia.
Wow. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Greg Palast. He's just back from Georgia. And we're talking about, there really is, it's an amazing moment in the history of this country, Greg. And it really revolves, one of the big stories is the one that you've been on for so long. And that's the trying to get this country to understand how dangerous this kind of vote stealing and all the various ways that we see the new Jim Crow in the 21st century. This, of course, is your beat. And if I've got it correct now, my understanding is that there are challenges of various kinds at various levels in 48 states. 48 states.
Yes.
Texas is getting ugly.
Yes, in fact. So it's massive new changes in rules, which are already bad. And I have to tell you, I want to tell you the story of what happened in Georgia, because that I just uncovered. I'm going to give you a teaser, but I can't give you all of it. But Georgia, it was really almost unnoticed. In fact, it was completely unnoticed in the national press that among the new things in this new Georgia law called SB 202, which was much covered because it has things like cutting the number of polling stations in African-American counties, cutting the times of drop boxes, so people can usually drop off their ballots after work, but they now have to put the boxes inside buildings, which close at 5 o'clock. That type of nonsense. And then, of course, infamously, the story we broke, which got a lot of national coverage, you can go to jail for felony charges if you hand someone a slice of pizza or a bottle of water while they're waiting in line. Amazing. Which was not only goofy, but particularly cruel, because the methods that they use, as I said, they cut the drop boxes, they cut the early voting hours, they cut the voting stations, means that in the hours that the stations are open, you're going to have longer lines. You're going to now triple these lines. They're hours and hours. At Emory University, and I remember in 18, the lines were 10 hours long. And at Spelman, which is a black college, lines were, I don't know, about 8 hours long. I mean, you have to understand, it's not a small thing when you say you can't give someone some water. So, but that's the small stuff. What has not been noticed in the press is that the new law allows an unlimited number of voter challenges by any voters. Now, what does this mean? It just says that Dennis Bernstein someone can challenge every single member of the Pacifica stations and say they shouldn't be allowed to vote. I have reasons that these people shouldn't be allowed to vote. Now, they can be cockamamie reasons. They usually are. But so, for example, in Georgia, in the runoff for the U.S. Senate, which, flipped the Senate to Democrat by bare margin, and they won two Senate seats, you had the GOP functionaries, mostly, and some right-wing nutcases, challenged 364,000 voters' right to vote. And since the challenge came December 15th, a lot of people had already mailed in their ballot, so they said, if someone's mailed in their ballot, you can't count the ballot. Or if they show up to vote, you got to give them a provisional ballot. Now, the only way that voter can have their ballot counted or their vote counted, they must go into the county board of elections. By the way, the great Raffensperger promoted this business, okay? He not only promoted it, but he welcomed it. He said, I can't do this under federal law, because federal law, you can't change voter rolls within 90 days of an election, of a federal election, for obvious reasons. But he literally invited outside right-wing groups to come in and break federal law, do what he can't do legally. Now, my question is, if you tell someone, I can't do this, but you can, when I worked with the Justice Department, that was a crime. You can't get out of a crime by having, otherwise every mob boss would be let off the hook, because they just simply have other people commit the crimes for them.
We're not denying climate change, but it could very well go back. We're talking about millions of years. They say that we had hurricanes that were far worse than what we just had with Michael.
Who says that? They say.
People say that in the...
Yeah, but what about the scientists who say it's worse than ever?
What about those scientists? Welcome to the Election Crimes Bulletin with our co-conspirator Greg Palast.
Yeah, right. North Carolina Republicans are hosting the man today, so I haven't heard any sound bites yet. Maybe I can't absorb any. Those are some historic ones. All right, it's already 10:24. That was a lead-in to the environmental section. Two from Sonali Kahatar. I haven't mentioned the great Antonia Yuhas whenever I get a chance to hear her. So I'm going to run those back-to-back, and whatever time left we'll have. Speaking of the virus, which I guess I should have said on the front end, it's the G7 meeting's happening, and there may be an announcement. There was this really bizarre, I thought, announcement made of giving a minuscule amount, if you look at the worldwide population around the world, of our surplus, including AstraZeneca, which South Africa says no thanks to. We don't want that one. There's still this... opportunity for the U.S. to take a lead on it and produce vaccines, and it goes through the Birch by amendment law. That's the law that actually allowed Big Pharma and other companies to gain profitably from research by funded by governments. But it also has a provision that it can enjoin them to license, and defense production could produce the inputs to a vaccine campaign to produce those materials that are needed. So the U.S. could actually lead, and this donation is, like, to me, is a smokescreen. The segment from Tax Justice, which looks more and more likely I'm not going to get to play much of, is about the G7 meeting to some extent, about the idea of having this minimum tax agreed on for corporations worldwide. How about that? Wouldn't it be a good idea? I think they're shooting for 15%, which it turns out to be the alternative minimum corporate tax. That's the latest thing that Biden's been talking about. Ireland would have to raise their corporate tax from 12 to 15. Many would be able to cut that still, because there's still Japan and Germany have high tax rates for corporations. I forget exactly, not as much as it used to be, but all right. Well, but now we're going to hear from a native voice from Minnesota, as I've been talking about. And then we'll hear Anthony Juhas, used to be with Oil Change International, which I thought was a great name for a group concerned with all the carbon going into the atmosphere.
Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. For years now, Indigenous leaders have organized resistance to the Line 3 pipeline that cuts through northern Minnesota. The pipeline, run by a Canadian oil company, Enbridge, would carry 700,000 barrels per day of dirty tar sands oil from Canada. Indigenous leaders say the project violates treaty rights. And to that end, they've organized a major gathering along the pipeline route from June 5th through 8th, saying that they have, quote, put out a call for people in all parts of the country to converge on Minnesota and engage in direct resistance. Leaders like my guest are calling on the Biden administration to step in and cancel the Line 3 pipeline. Nancy Beaulieu is co-founder of RISE, which stands for Resilient Indigenous Sisters Engaging Coalition. She's also the Northern Minnesota organizer for 350.org. Welcome to the program, Nancy.
Well, thanks for having me. And I'm calling in here from the beautiful town of Bemidji, Minnesota, and just want people to know I am a citizen of the Leech Lake Reservation. So this pipeline is threatening our way of life here as Indigenous people. So I'm more than happy to be, you know, here and tell the world why we are, you know, having this treaty people gathering from June 8th through the 5th.
So how does this pipeline, or how would it violate treaty agreements?
Well, you know, we never at any time in any of our treaties surrendered our inherent right to hunt, fish, travel, and gather. And part of, you know, our cultural way of life is dependent upon water. Our Manoomin, the wild rice, is also dependent on clean water. So Line 3 threatens the existence of our way of, you know, being here. And we've been here since in time immemorial. And I just wanted to say that, you know, we're going to continue to be here, and we need the wild rice, and we need clean water. We depend on fish, and our people used to migrate around the seasons, and we are people of the river. So clean water is really, really important to not just us, but to our treaty partners as well, people like yourself.
So the treaty people gathering is taking place June 5th through 8th. And I understand that by the term treaty people, you include all Americans, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, because as your website says, we're all responsible for preserving and respecting these treaties.
That is correct. You know, there's a misconception out there that we were giving the right to hunt, fish, travel, and gather. But yet is we gave the Europeans the right to, you know, do all those things, to hunt, fish, travel, and gather. And so we are out here through our work with RISE Coalition and our work at Minnesota 350, educating people that our ancestors signed those with your ancestors. And treaties are very much alive today as the day they were signed. And so we feel because of the environmental and racial injustice, the current government, and that's local, state, and federal, have put us in, you know, in a way where it's so dispiriting for us because we have no voice in any matter. So what we're doing is we are educating here, especially in Minnesota, you know, all those elected officials from local, state to federal, that everybody has a responsibility to the treaties. And they were intended for us to live in peace as good neighbors and to leave the earth in a better way than we found it. So as Indigenous people, we have the inherent responsibility to, you know, protect the water and all that is sacred. And as settlers, the people that signed those treaties with our ancestors, they have an obligation to uphold those treaties. So we are out here, you know, calling on all of our, you know, citizens of the United States, because, you know, regardless of what political party you belong to, what church you go to, or how you self-identify, treaties are all of our responsibility, and they are a nonpartisan issue as well. So we're trying to work across all levels of government, both parties, all parties, to say treaties do matter.
So how does the movement around Line 3 build on the movements around the Keystone XL pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the gathering in Standing Rock? Do you see this effort and this coming gathering in early June as a continuation of those struggles?
I do, you know, and like I mentioned before, our words continue to fall on deaf ears. So our situation in Line 3 here is no different from what we saw in Standing Rock or with the Keystone XL. They're the same exact thing, just different tribes. And we feel that, you know, it's time, because we're at a point in history where we're trying to have reparations and do right by all, you know, people and all living things. And so I feel we're in the same struggle, and I feel the same sense of a beautiful movement that we've seen in Standing Rock. So we are here gathering in a peaceful treaty solidarity movement on June 5th through the 8th.
And so you're asking people to sign up via your website and to make arrangements to physically be there. So it's going to be part of, you know, I'm assuming along some part of the route of the pipeline itself. And there might be the kinds of actions that we saw at Standing Rock taking place.
Well, you know, there's a website that people can follow if they really want to, you know, help us out. Even if you can't, you know, be here with your boots on the ground, there's so many different ways you can help. But you could find out more about this gathering at treatypeoplegathering.com, and you can sign a form to get registered and find out all the different ways you can help. So you can help from, you know, just cooking in camp. You can help, you know, being, you know, creating spaces during those actions. So the actions are going to be peaceful. They're going to be nonviolent. And yes, I see that there are going to be some similarities. We are going to, you know, peacefully resist this pipeline. And we're calling on all of our allies across Turtle Island to come here to Northern Minnesota and help support clean water in the future, because we're all dependent upon the water.
So when people sign up for joining you at this gathering, I'm assuming that the whole point is not just to express your resistance to the local authorities in Minnesota, but also the Biden administration, right? Can the president simply cancel this pipeline with a stroke of the pen, or is there some longer process you think he needs to go through?
No, I think it's just a stroke of a pen. And, you know, we've seen, you know, Standing Rock and their legal you know, challenges they had and how they had, you know, won. And I feel too, not only should Biden stop Line 3, but he should really step in and hold these corporate giants responsible for the mess they're leaving here, us in this, you know, beautiful country of ours. And it's just not fair that it seems, you know, corporations are just buying their way through lobbying, you know, our politicians and buying their way through our beautiful landscape here. And it's, and, you know, another thing we can't forget about too, and not just Biden, it's the Walz administration. Governor Walz here in Minnesota kind of pledged his way through his campaign that there would be no Line 3. And it's kind of ironic because he has an executive order 19-24 where it's, again, government to government. But how do you respectfully, you know, treat your tribal or tribal nations here in Minnesota in a good way if you are forcing a pipeline down their throat? Because we know White Earth, Red Lake, and Mille Lacs reservations still have yet to have their day in court. But the Walz administration gave Enbridge the green light back in December. You know, we can't let Governor Walz off the hook here neither.
President Biden did cancel the Keystone XL pipeline with a stroke of a pen. And it was something that President Obama did so late in his tenure that President Trump, following him, was able to undo that decision. Presumably, the Keystone XL pipeline will remain canceled, and it remains to be seen what Mr. Biden will do on Line 3. But you mentioned that the issue of legal rights, I mean, if there are treaty violations, is there some sort of lawsuit that's working its way through courts right now?
Yeah, and those are some of our, you know, organizations such as Honor the Treaty and whatnot. And we, as people of Minnesota Chippewa Tribe, we are also having another side of the resistance. It's within our own elected officials as chairman, secretary, treasurers, and representatives of each nation. And we have not had no free, prior, and informed consent on any level of government. So there is a violation of our Minnesota Chippewa Tribe Constitution as well, and not just a violation of the treaties.
Now, when we talk about, and when the president talks about, and leaders like Governor Walz talk about renewable energy, climate-friendly issues, solving the climate crisis, why don't they bring these pipelines into it? I mean, a pipeline that transports hundreds of thousands of barrels of dirty tar sands a day across the country in the short term, of course, presents the risks to the land and the water. In the long term, feeds the climate crisis. One would think that these pipelines, like, for example, coal power plants, canceling them would be a no-brainer. Why are they so attached to these pipelines? Is it just an issue of profits?
It's yes, exactly. It's like profits over people. We know it's about power. It's about, you know, I hate to say it, but it's about the 1% who is really in charge of our government here. And it's like, again, I mentioned earlier, the lobbying and the payoffs, it's everywhere. So what we need to do, you know, we're really political in this movement as well. And I want to say that we have to get the dark money out of our campaigns. And we also have to work harder to get more of our native relatives and our like-minded allies in local and state and government positions as well. And we see that happening. And we're really excited about, you know, what 2022 is going to bring and beyond, because we're learning how to play that game and we're going to learn how to play it better.
If the pipeline gets canceled and joins the ranks of Keystone XL and other canceled pipelines, what's the next step? How do you see ending these pipelines as part of the movement, the Indigenous-led movement for climate justice? How do you see it as part of justice for Indigenous communities?
Well, you know, it'll honestly, if we can be heard, we'll have hope that there are better things to happen. And most importantly, we have to work on healthy relationships despite the differences that we might have. And we have to talk about, you know, the Green New Deal and you know, scaling back on what we're doing, because our disposable convenient lifestyles are no longer working. So we have to think about how we can move forward in a way that's environmentally and racially grounded, based around treaty obligations. Because again, treaties don't only protect us as Native people, they protect the people that sign those treaties with us. And so if we ground ourselves in those kind of relationships, I see a lot of good things happening. And we see a lot of, you know, green type of companies, you know, coming to the forefront now. And we're excited about that. But we need to have those hard conversations and wean ourselves off of oil and move into a green new energy deal.
And so a Green New Deal is part of a solution that you envision, you know, the canceling these pipeline projects, it offers a stepping stone toward a vision like the Green New Deal?
Right, you know, because, you know, we're not here trying to take anyone's job away from them. We're just trying to find a future that, you know, we all can imagine together. And the Green New Deal will actually create more long-term jobs. And we don't talk about that enough, but these are not just like the pipeline where they're working for, you know, so many months out of the project and then they're done. And then there's only 21 permanent jobs left, you know, after the pipeline is put in. We're talking windmill maintenance and, you know, solar panel maintenance and all these good things. And, you know, people say, well, it takes oil to make that. But you know what? When you think about the emissions in the end and the constant driving we do and the way we live, if we can minimize, that's a path forward. And I think we have to work on that together, regardless of where we come from or where we're going. We all need clean water and fresh air.
And let me also ask you about Enbridge, this company that's running Line 3 and would basically be operating the Line 3 pipeline and building it. This is a company that seems, at least according to some reports, to be very happy to rely on law enforcement to break up any resistance. They've been caught, you know, seeking to influence law enforcement leadership positions. They're financing private security firms, reimbursing police for policing of these protests that show up. So it seems as though they are prepared, just as the Dakota Access Pipeline protesters saw violent police reaction. I imagine that people protesting Line 3 have seen and will see some police violence.
Right. You know, that's exactly true. And it's, you know, similar to, you know, the violence that we've seen in Standing Rock. And I reside here in Beltrami County in Minnesota. And the current pipeline runs through this county. But when the new corridor, again, you know, people are, you know, misled by that. This is not a replacement. It's a new corridor that will run, run through over 200, you know, bodies of water. And it's going to cross, go under the Mississippi twice and under Shell River five times. So this is a new corridor and it's actually leaving our county here. But yet our county, Beltrami County, is supporting, you know, the Line 3, build here. They're supporting Enbridge. And what's really, really disheartening is that this county is surrounded by White Earth, Red Lake, and Leech Lake. And all three tribes oppose that pipeline. And what's even further disheartening is that this county's economic prosperity is dependent upon those three tribal nations and, you know, buying batons and riot gear is not a way to treat your tribal neighboring nations, especially, you know, again, I mentioned earlier, treaties intended for us to live in peace. And this is not what this pipeline is going to bring us.
What about the fact that there is now an interior secretary like Deb Haaland, who is a Native American indigenous activist, who in fact was at Standing Rock as an activist, as an indigenous leader? It's the first time in the country's history that the position of interior secretary has been occupied by an indigenous person. Can her position, you know, have any influence over the future of this pipeline?
You know, that's a tough question to answer, but I would, you know, want to answer from my heart and believe that, you know, Deb will make a difference in moving, maybe, you know, maybe not in the immediate future here, but I think, you know, as we move along in this resistance and we give Deb Haaland more support and we continue to call on Biden, I think, you know, I think what he needs to do himself is have that government to government relationship that he too promised. And he needs to start by engaging more with Ms. Haaland and making sure there's some meaning into that executive order, because this pipeline or any other pipeline threatens that existence. And we need to honor Ms. Haaland for the good work, for the knowledge and for the experience that she brings to this cabinet. And I feel, you know, as indigenous people, that's one of the best times to take and have a good heart and listen and make something work for all of us. And I think, you know, Deb Haaland is going to make, you know, some good things happen. And we have to keep supporting her and making sure that she is not being ignored as well.
Nancy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
I want to thank you for having me. And I also want to, you know, encourage, you know, people that are watching to come out and join us June 5th through 8th. And again, you can get signed up at thetreatypeoplegathering.com and make sure that you help support the future, and it belongs to those not even born yet. So we're just borrowing this time here on Earth, and we have to be respectful about it. So again, no line three.
My guest has been Nancy Beaulieu, co-founder of RISE, which stands for Resilient Indigenous Sisters Engaging Coalition. And she's also the Northern Minnesota organizer for 350.org. We've been discussing the June 5th through.
Okay. I thought I edited a little better than that. It was on the fly. And the other one was this line three. Either way, you can find that pretty quickly. Nancy Beaulieu, treatypeoplegathering.com, stopline3.org. That's going on right now. There's some festival stuff going on. Maybe I won't even play any of the text cast since I'm hyping it for tomorrow. Taxjustice.net, if you want to look for it. Excuse me. Again, that was mass mobilization against Line 3, Enbridge. Another Enbridge pipeline. We're going to go on with Anthony Duhas, formerly of Oil Change International, also with Sonali Kahatkar. Pheasant Hollow Wines.com. Info for the Dennis Stromont, Rob Crum, Cajun thing starting 2 this afternoon. Whittington, Illinois. I don't know where that is. I think it's south and east of here. So if you're up for a road trip in Cajun music and you don't mind doing something impromptu. In town, there's the Hog Bowl, which is a mashup of a Hog Shoot, which is this long series sort of, they call it Americana Festival, but Americana would be Brazilian too, wouldn't it, since they're all in America. The sort of indigenous rootsy music is generally a long list of players. You can find that at the Rose Bowl Facebook page and probably their website too. Two to whenever. Includes that great band, Cold Bridges and the Overpass. I love that name. And in fact, some kindreds of mine, not kindreds, there's some people from the St. Clair, Washington County line in Southern Illinois that are in that group, so that's a good thing. They do some fine stuff. Under the tent, as I like to say, it's intense at the Rose Bowl. Here's Sonali again with Antonia Juhas. Love her stuff.
Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A civil court in the Netherlands recently issued a landmark ruling against one of the world's largest fossil fuel companies, ordering Royal Dutch Shell to cut its emissions by 45% from 2019 levels. The Hague Court, whose decision could have far-reaching implications, ruled that the British-Dutch multinational corporation is responsible for the emissions that its products create, and therefore must comply with the requirements of the Paris Accord. The case was brought by the Dutch chapter of Friends of the Earth and could be replicated in other nations and with other major oil and gas corporations as part of the ongoing battle against climate change. We turn now to Antonia Juhas, a leading energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist. She is currently a Bertha Fellow in Investigative Journalism and an award-winning writer who's contributed to outlets like Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Harper's Magazine, The Atlantic, CNN.com, The Nation, and more. She's written several books, including The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, and Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Her latest article in Rolling Stone is entitled, A Court Ruled Shell is Liable for Its Contributions to Climate Change. What Happens Now? Welcome to the program, Antonia.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali. Great to be with you.
So first, let's start with what is the significance of this ruling? Is this the first time that a private corporation has been held accountable to the standards set by the Paris Accord?
Yeah, it's just a landmark historic ruling. So the Dutch court ruled that Shell is liable for its contributions to climate change, and it must change its operations as a result. And as you've said, governments have been held to account on the standard by courts before, including the Dutch Supreme Court. But this is the first time that a company has been held to the same standard. And so the court said that Shell also has an obligation to essentially stop climate change, because climate change creates a devastating harm that harms guaranteed protected human rights. And in order to avert those harms to the climate and basic guaranteed human rights, Shell has to revert its contribution to climate change and cut its emissions by 45% in 9 years.
Of course, Shell responded with great disappointment and then proceeded to point out all of the ways in which it was doing these amazing, great things to further the cause of climate justice and to address climate change. And if you read the Shell response, it certainly sounds very, very noble. How do you assess Shell's response to this ruling?
Well, the court actually really has a very strong retort and very careful retort to Shell's responses. Shell didn't come up with anything new in its response to the ruling. It reiterated claims that it had already made during the case, which the court had already shot down. So what Shell said is that they're already planning to get to net zero by 2050. And what the court said was its plan is too unspecific. It is too, it takes too long to get there. And it's too difficult to account for the net zero obligation that Shell is putting forward. Basically, it was insufficient on every count. And so the court said, we're going to give you a specific cut, a specific timeline in which to achieve it. And we're going to tell you, in some cases, this is some of the most important parts of the case, everything that you need to account for when you determine that 45% cut. So what the court said was that Shell has to account, when it looks at all of its emissions, for the emissions that the company releases when it produces its products, for the emissions that are released when its suppliers provide its products, and also when its consumers burn its product. So that's a full accounting in climate parlance, that scope 1, 2, and 3, basically a life cycle approach to when you dig the product out of the ground, when you transport it through a pipeline or on a ship, when you turn it into a petrochemical, when you store it in a field, and when your consumer uses it in a car, in an airplane, in a truck. All of those emissions, Shell has to account for all of them everywhere in the world, all of its subsidiaries, and reduce them by 45%. And the court also said, you know, we're not going to tell Shell how to do that, but it's pretty clear that it will probably have to keep certain fossil fuels. It won't be able to extract. It's going to need to pull back and essentially keep some of its fossil fuels in the ground. And that those involved in the case said, you know, basically looking at Shell's footprint everywhere, it's almost impossible to imagine that Shell can cut its emissions at that speed and at that scale and in that scope without it impacting its operations everywhere, including the United States.
Wow. So this sort of full accounting that the court is requiring Shell to do is a kind of accounting that climate justice activists have often put on these companies. You know, as you said, that it takes a lot of energy to extract, energy to transport, and then, of course, the burning itself on the other end that these companies do have to be responsible for. I imagine that ExxonMobil, Chevron, and all of these other companies are watching in trepidation with what the Dutch court has ruled. How could Friends of the Earth or other climate justice organizations replicate this victory in other courts, in other nations, and for other companies? Because it's not just Shell, obviously.
Well, and again, this is where the judgment by the court is so important and so sweeping, because the court also said other companies are also going to be held to account. So Shell has an individual responsibility to address its own operations, which is what the court said. But it also said, you know, basically this is going to need to include other companies. And that's really important. And even before campaigners start to do anything, the message that the court has said to investors, to shareholders, to banks, to others to executives at oil companies is your company is going to be held individually liable for its contribution to climate change. If you don't want that to happen to you, you need to pull out of these investments, stop backing fossil fuel companies, or really change the activities of your own company. So I think even before any individual campaigner does anything, and they are planning to do a lot of things, that message has already gone out. And even if Shell appeals, which they said they intend to do, it's important to point out that it is the Dutch system that had the Urinda case, which was the other precedent setting case that held the Dutch government liable to ensure that it cuts emissions to uphold, to avert the worst of the climate crisis. That case was also in a Dutch court. It also went to the Dutch Supreme Court, where the Dutch Supreme Court upheld the lower court's ruling. So this is also a Dutch court. This is a district court. If Shell appeals, it has two opportunities to appeal. It's still going to appeal within that same system. So I think given the way that the court drafted its findings, I would honestly be surprised if Shell won its appeals. But in any case, if we're looking at, you know, what next for the campaigners and others who pushed this case, they're already planning other lawsuits against other companies. And activists in the United States have said that while there isn't a precedent that's legally set through the Dutch court to U.S. courts, the finding can definitely reverberate through the lawsuits that are already underway in the United States that are trying to make the case that oil companies are responsible for their contribution to climate change. That's essentially the basis of all of the cases that are floating through US courts right now. And this certainly provides evidence that another court, a very significant court, finds that not only to be true, but that companies have to change their own practices as a result, because most of the US cases are essentially asking for damages. Oil companies have harmed the climate. We, the governments who are the people bringing most of these cases, have had to pay lots of costs as a result of these damages, and therefore you, the oil company, needs to pay us back. Mm. This goes even further, and it says the company itself has to change its activities. So that certainly provides at least a basis of argumentation, if not a precedent, that those companies have a responsibility and therefore also potentially a liability to all of those local communities, state governments, national governments that have had to bear such a strong cost for climate change. And of course, also those local communities. So I interviewed Janet Redmond with Greenpeace US, and she said, you know, she wants to look at reparations. What about local Black, Indigenous, people of color communities across the United States that have borne the brunt of fossil fuels in the climate crisis? Maybe oil companies owe them reparations as well.
So it just seems to me also that the Dutch court ruling is the kind of ruling that is considered anathema here in the United States, where we have made private corporations and their right to a profit supreme over the right of human beings to, you know, have clean water, air and health. And that it, you know, maybe in European nations, at least there's still some semblance of upholding human rights over corporate profits. Here in the US, we just have relegated the so-called free market to solve, you know, the major problems of humanity, but of course it has ended up creating the major problems of humanity. There's also the one court case that is still, I believe, in process, which is a number of young people around the country saying that fossil fuel companies are violating their constitutional rights as our climate trust, I believe, our children's trust, I believe, which is one of many, many lawsuits wending their way through courts. I don't know if you have any thoughts on how this is going to happen in the US.
There's thousands of cases still active in the United States right now. So, you know, I think...
But we also have a very conservative judiciary, thanks to Trump.
Well, we do, but I don't think it's... I think it's premature to give up on this legal process. So I think that, you know, no, the United States doesn't have, for example, a constitutional provision that guarantee fundamental human rights like the Dutch system has. We don't have provisions that other countries have, for example, with rights to nature. You know, but that, the precedent in other countries contributes to a basis of understanding and sort of what is the pre-existing understanding of those who are involved in these deciding these issues. What is the basis of understanding on which law needs to be decided? So what the Dutch court said was, by signing the Paris Climate Accord, governments around the world have committed themselves to this, to the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that that is a standard now that needs to be upheld through law, that we've created a global commitment that needs to be upheld. And again, it's not the same legal system here in the United States, but every time a decision is made that upholds an international norm, it helps those who are arguing these cases in the United States to explain that this is the norm, that reality of climate change is the norm, that the climate needs to be held to 1.5 degrees Celsius is the norm. And now that individual oil companies have responsibility to do that is also the norm. And that's also going to help, even if it doesn't, well, we'll see where it goes on the climate cases, but also the case is going to be made to policymakers in the United States. Joe Biden has said, you know, that he has a firm commitment to the Paris Climate Accord. Well, now this court says if you have a firm commitment to the Paris Climate Accord, that means you're also going to hold individual companies to account. And as you had started to ask about Exxon and Chevron, so these are two companies that have really strongly resisted this full accounting model, that they need to account for all of their emissions. And at the same time that the court in the Dutch court was bringing down its ruling on Shell, Chevron's shareholders pushed through a resolution against the management's wishes, saying the same thing to Chevron. You have to reduce the emissions of all of your emissions, including the emissions released when people use your product. So Chevron's shareholders made it do that. And over at Exxon, there was a activist push to, again, going very much against the wishes of Exxon's management, to get two people named onto the board, voted onto the board, who have as their clear mandate pushing the company to be more aggressive and change its practices to address for climate change.
Antonia, where can people find out more about the work that you do?
My Rolling Stone article, which just came out, and all of my other articles are on my website. It's my name, AntoniaJuhas.net, and hopefully you can see my name at the bottom of the screen.
Antonia, JUHASZ.net for our radio audience. You can also always check out risingupwithsonali.com for a link. Antonia, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
My guest has been Antonia Juhas. She is a leading energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist, and currently a Bertha Fellow in investigative journalism. She's written numerous books, and her latest article in Rolling Stone is called A Court Ruled Shell is Liable for Its Contributions to Climate Change. What happens now? I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Again, our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Here I am engaged in conversation when I ought to be listening, right? Well, I heard that at least a couple of times. Antonia Juhas, formerly of Oil Change International. You can find that with Rising Up with Sonali, who I think is still producing at a high clip, even though I think maybe the Pacifica Network hasn't only puts her on once a week. I think at her home station at KPFK, she's still on. And I'm not going to try to put even a taste of the Tax Justice Network, so I'm going to package that in a program for tomorrow if everything goes well. So maybe I'll fulminate about the Bob Dole, Birch Bayh Act, which is the act that I just said something at the top, but it's worth repeating since this G7 posturing is going to be going on. And the U.S. did this magnanimous trickle of surplus vaccinations, and they turned it into a political act by saying, and we don't have any clauses. We're not asking anything in return. We're just giving it, while Big Pharma is making money hand over fist, selling and not giving up on their patent rights, which they ought to just do because they got so much money from the government. Birch Dole bill is the bill that actually allowed for the privatization of the value of government research. I forget exactly. It was signed by Carter, so it was the late 70s when it passed. But that the rationale at the time was that this research wasn't being put into implementation, that corporations, of course, are the people that can do that best. So we have to let them make a boatload of money on it. But the same bill actually allows the government to enjoin these corporations that got so much government largesse to actually force them to license other organizations and make the virus, vaccination, I mean. And that could be done unilaterally. It would be a great way for the U.S. to lead. Obviously, I'm not holding my breath.
Oh, you said months ago, open source.
Yeah, open source. Yeah, I got that line from somebody on Democracy Now! It would be great to open source. But the Defense Production Act, which was used for a while to keep the export of materials for making vaccinations in the country, could actually be used to accelerate the production of this and ship it to the places around the world we're going to need it, because we need billions of vaccine, not this 17 million or whatever they're talking about. I'm sure but there'll be another tranche announced at the G7 just because it's supposed to look good. All right. Opinions you hear here, those are the speakers, not necessarily shared. I already played an underwriting announcement because I needed 40 seconds to get my show together, and it worked. So we're going to kick it with the theme song of the Radio Free Labor Hour. I did one pitch of the show. And thanks for listening. Enjoy the day. And I don't know. Sign up to the People's Treaty.